Hi there. Welcome to Boomer Tubes Podcast, the place for baby boomers to come play with your own age group. I'm Deb, and I'm your host. Before we get into today's show, I want to make sure to let you know that we would love to make your story a part of our podcast. So please visit our website for info on how to submit stories or music. If you have a unique, funny, or poignant anecdote about growing up, your teenage years, music, cars, dating, your parents, anything you think our listeners might enjoy, send it to us. We're boomers, and most of us were raised by the greatest generation, an exceptional group of people who deserve our enduring respect. And with that, here we go. I'm excited about today's show because we have a very special guest with us, Steve Snyder. Steve and I have some significant things in common, which is how we came to know each other. And today, we're here to visit with Steve about a cherished project that has become a major part of his life. A graduate of UCLA, Steve Snyder lives in Seal Beach, California. In 2009, he retired from Vision Service Plan after a 36-year career working in sales and sales management. He then began his quest to learn more about the World War II experience of his father, pilot Howard Snyder, and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. It became his passion, and after 4.5 years of dedicated research, resulted in his book, Shot Down, which has received 25 book awards. A member of numerous World War II organizations, Steve is past president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association. He keeps very busy making PowerPoint presentations to all types of organizations and attending air shows around the country, signing copies of his book. So with that, welcome to the show, Steve.
Well, thanks a lot, Deb. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, our pleasure. This is exciting stuff for me. So let's begin by having you tell us what the book is about.
Okay. Well, it was on a bombing mission in February of 1944, where my dad's plane was attacked by two German Focke-Wulf fighters and shot down over the French-Belgium border. And the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew and about all the Belgian people that risked their lives to help them. The first half of the book builds up to the day they were shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards. And the story is all based on firsthand testimony by the people that were involved in the events that took place. What I added was just a lot of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it into context and give it background.
Wow. You know, and I love that you mentioned that the entire book is written from information and documentation you have from your dad's time as a pilot, and that you also included stories about members of his crew. I'm reading the book right now, by the way.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So, yeah, how did you come to write this book? What brought you to this major event in your life?
Oh, gosh. Well, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England, the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. He flew bombing missions over Europe, and as I mentioned, he was shot down. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. Wow. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. My parents had kept a lot of material about the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and learn more details, organize it. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. That's absolutely riveting, which is in the book. And then the other item were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in Europe before being shot down. And reading those letters is absolutely fascinating. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. And I started doing all this research about the air war over Europe and the 8th Air Force. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so compelling and so unique that it needed to be told. People needed to learn about it. And so I decided to write a book.
And, you know, how can you not share that information with, first of all, I am so envious of the amount of information you have about your dad, because my dad's info is very sketchy and I'm having to dig big time. But I'm so envious of the amount of information you have. And the second thing is, again, how can you not share that with the world? Because, as you say, it's such a unique experience and it has to be shared just from a historical standpoint. It's significant stuff. It's compelling, and his story needs to be told. I'm just so happy to find this book and to read it. And it's just a lot of parallels, although my dad was with the 12th flying out of North Africa. But other than that, there's a lot of parallels as far as the B-17 and what they did on a daily basis. How did your dad's plane get shot down?
Well, it was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, again on February 8th of 44, where they dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, flak, and they couldn't get the doors back up. And as a result, that caused the drag on the plane. They started losing airspeed, and they fell behind the bomber formation, heading back to England and their bases.
Oh, boy.
And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, and like wolves or lions, you know, swooping in on prey, they attacked the Susan Ruth and shot it down. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. B-17 had a 10-man crew. Yep. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. But both those German Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and his plane crashed, and he died in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. And
Wow.
During my research, one day my wife said, "Well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking, "No, she's naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It's right. A ridiculous idea."
Yeah.
But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, and he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force during World War II.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable that you had the opportunity to talk to him. And from his perspective, what was that like, shooting down your dad's plane? Oh, my gosh.
Well, yeah, I was so excited. And talking with Hans, I found out that the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans down at the same time. They shot each other down.
Wow.
But we've become friends, and interestingly enough, of all the people that are involved in the shot down story, Hans is the only one who's still living. He's 97 years old now, lives in Munich, Germany, and I've gone over and visited him a couple of times, and we've become friends.
That is unbelievable. I mean, how many people can say that they've tracked down this person? I mean, what a crazy story. My gosh. What happened to your dad after he bailed out?
Well, he came down into some trees right at the French-Belgian border. His parachute got hung up on the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvin, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. That night, they took him to the Durvin farmhouse, and he only stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous because there was German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. Mm-hmm. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed at any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night. He might spend 6 weeks.
Wow.
And finally, after several months, he got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th, and he decided to get back into the fight. Unlike most airmen, before he went in the Air Force, he was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington, in the Army, in the infantry, mm-hmm. so he knew how to fight on the ground.
Right.
So he decided to join the French Resistance, and he joined up with a unit, the Mackie, they were called. One of his helpers escorted him across the border from Belgium into France. And he fought with them for a couple of months, sabotaging German convoys.
Wow.
And then finally, 7 months after being shot down, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into town. The town square went up to an army major, identified himself, and they interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. Then he caught a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then hopped on a transport to go back to England, where he sent a telegram to my mother saying, "Fit as a fiddle, honey. Thank the money." Because he had all that back pay coming.
Wow. And 7 months. 7 months hiding out. That's not a lot of guys can say that, because I know there were less than ideal outcomes from a lot of those guys that were hidden or tried to be hidden.
Man. Yeah, it took a lot of guts, a lot of courage, and a lot of bravery to make the decision to join the French Resistance. The safest or wisest thing to do would have been just to stay hunkered down and in hiding and wait for the U.S. troops to come up from France or from to liberate the country. But he thought it was his duty to get back and fight the Germans.
Well, you know,
not many people would have made that decision.
No, you're right. But you know, that's how those guys were wired. I mean, they did not hesitate. It was their duty. They were there to win the war. I'm not surprised at all that he made that decision. He obviously felt he was equipped to do so, and here we go. I just love that. I haven't made it that far in the book yet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, there's both when he's in hiding, there's several instances described in the book where he was almost discovered by the Gestapo, the German secret police. And then there's also several encounters that are described in the book that his French resistance group had with the Germans, which are quite thrilling and exciting.
My gosh. My gosh. Now, you had said that two crew members died when they shot the plane down. What about the other guys on the plane?
Well, five of the crew made it back home, but five of them did not. Three of the crew were captured immediately and became prisoners of war.
Okay.
Two of them were so seriously injured that they were repatriated back to the U.S. before the war ended.
I see.
I'm hesitant to tell you this because you're going to know everything before you read the book.
I know. Well, and listeners too, right? We can't ruin everything for everybody. Oh, you know something else I meant to tell you too. I read in the book that you said, and was it Anaheim where he graduated? When he got his pilot's training?
Well, he went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana.
Air Base. Okay.
In California. He actually graduated from advanced pilot training, where he received his pilot's wing and his commission as a second lieutenant in Douglas, Arizona.
Okay. Well, the reason that it kind of struck me was his class was 43D, correct?
43D. That's correct.
My dad's was 43C.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure he was in California when he got his wings. So I don't know.
Well, there were lots of airfields and flight schools and pilot training locations. He graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 43.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And my dad actually graduated in the fall of 42. So I think he might have been just a tad bit ahead of your dad. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I can't read to finish this book. I'm just so looking forward to the rest of it. And, you know, I although my dad has a similar story, of course, you know, it's from the 12th Air Force perspective. So, but I am reading a lot of similarities, and it's just very compelling stuff.
Yeah, it was brutal flying combat missions in the Air Force over Europe. Being a combat airman in over the European theater was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II.
Yeah, and I don't think many people realize that. I know that it was tough on the ground, but, I mean, that's why they originally assigned these guys 25 missions. I mean, the odds of them making it 25 were pretty slim, were they not? I mean, especially going in.
Yeah, they initially there was no, at least in the 8th Air Force, there was no mission limit. The first mission in the 8th Air Force was in August of 42. Mm-hmm. And the morale of these guys, of these air crews, combat crews, was going in the tank because they knew they'd never make it home. They'd either be killed or be shot down and become POWs.
Yeah, yeah.
But the 8th Air Force put in the 25 mission limit in the spring of 1943. But during that year, 43, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions.
Yeah, and I know that just from a mental standpoint, it was horrible. And hence the like flak leave and all the leave where they had to get those guys out of there for a while because, you know, prior to having a name, which what now is called PTSD, I mean,
right.
It took its toll. It took its toll. So, yeah. Man. What was I going to ask you? Oh, okay. So now how many missions did he actually fly?
My dad was shot down on his 8th mission. Some of his crew had more missions. Some of his crew had fewer missions. One of his waist gunners, you know, was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero at the altitude. They were flying, and so frostbite was a huge problem. And one of my dad's waist gunners was in the hospital for 2.5 months with serious frostbite injuries. And then one of my dad's ball turret gunner was injured. He couldn't fly for a while. My dad, he was tall. Back then, he was 6'3" and played center on the squadron basketball team at 6'3". But he tore the ligaments in his ankle, and he couldn't fly for 2 months. So like his navigator and co-pilot and the bombardier, they actually had more missions than my dad did.
Gotcha. Well, you know, and that's the other thing. Along with just the sheer trauma of flying the daily missions, there was things like frostbite and oxygen issues, you know, communications, everything they had to deal with the forts and everything that flying at 20 to 30,000 feet entailed in 1940, 41, 42, 43.
Yeah, it just wasn't the flak and the enemy fighters. I mean, it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time when they came back and landed.
Yeah, yeah. I actually read something the other day. One of the guys said that his biggest fear was takeoff. He figured if they could get in into the air loaded with those bombs, that was half the battle.
Well, you also have to consider that in England with the 8th Air Force. You had hundreds of bombers taken off from these bases all at the same time to go out on missions. And back then there was no radar. There was no air traffic control. And the weather was usually socked in and they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon at all.
Oh, I know. And you read stories about this. I mean, all of a sudden one pops out of the cloud, bam.
Exactly.
Yeah. Man. Okay, well, where can people find your book, Steve? Is it on Amazon or?
Yeah, most people obtain the book on Amazon. It's available in all formats, hardcover, paperback, and in the print book, there's over 200 time period photographs, so you can visualize everything you're reading about.
Yes.
But it's also available in all ebook formats and as an Audible book. If someone wants an autographed copy, they can go to my website, which is stevesnyderauthor.com, Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R.
Okay.
stevesnyderauthor.com, where they can get a signed autographed copy. And on my website, it's just not about my book. There's a ton of historical information about the air war over Europe, interviews with veterans, links to all sorts of different research sites. So you can, there's just a ton of information on my website.
I was on your website, and you have put some serious work into that, sir. That is no small feat. I know my husband builds websites, and that's no picnic. That's a lot of information.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else, Steve, we'll make sure that all your website, everything is noted on our show notes for the podcast so that folks can find you. What is your preference as far as the best way for folks to contact you? Is it through the website or, you know, what's your preference there?
Oh, well, all my contact information is on there.
Okay.
My email is just steve@stevesnyderauthor.com.
Gotcha. Okay, perfect.
So people can send me emails too. As you mentioned, I am so fortunate and so blessed to know so much about what happened to my dad and each member of his crew.
Yeah.
Because as you mentioned, you know, most people know very little about their veteran. I've been to Belgium 6 times. Doing research, make some great friends over there. Where the area where my dad was shot down, it was right at the French-Belgian border. That area is all rural farmland. So all these houses and farms where my dad and other members of the crew were hidden or stayed are still there.
It just gives me chills.
So it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing to go into the buildings and into rooms where my dad stayed, you know, 75 years ago. So it's... It's pretty special.
Yeah, that's crazy. I had a gentleman telling me that I needed to go over and find where my dad's plane went down. But man, I don't know that there was enough pieces left to even try it because, I mean, it was blown out of the air and it was in pieces. So, you know, that's going to take a little bit of homework, I think.
Well, it's in those countries that were occupied by the Germans, I mean, they to this day, they're still so thankful and grateful for the Americans and the Allies coming to their rescue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And lots of memorials, like in Belgium, there's a memorial to my dad and his crew in the little village of Mackenlaws near where the plane came down.
Yes.
And they have ceremonies every year at these little memorials. And there's still people around that, you know, remember, you know, what took place.
Yeah, yeah. That is just, and that is pure gold, is it not? I mean, there's just nothing that can replace that. It's so great that they're remembering this and continue to be grateful. And all the folks that maintain the graves and the grave sites, too, for the American aviators, is just overwhelming. It's so great.
Absolutely, yeah. Two of my dad's crew who were killed are buried in Europe, one at the Ardennes American Cemetery in Belgium and one at the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margraten.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, those people are, there's a waiting list to adopt a grave, as they call it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that is so great. I mean, you know, in a good way. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, and they on Memorial Day or special days, they, you know, all the people who have adopted graves, you know, they bring flowers and so they're very conscientious. And like I say, to this day, they are so grateful.
Man.
And they do a great job of educating the younger generations too about the importance.
Yeah.
You know, the United States has never experienced having our country occupied by an enemy and losing every single freedom that you have.
Yeah.
So they really cherish their freedom over in Europe.
They lived it. They lived it. And you know, at the risk of, I don't want to get political or anything, but I really wish that our teaching institutions would do a better job of teaching history to young people because they need to know this. Just because they've never experienced it doesn't make it any less important, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And that's really the reason I do what I do, you know, going to these air shows and doing all these presentations is to try to keep the memory of these great, these wonderful men alive, as you said, the greatest generation.
Yeah, I love those pictures. The other day, I saw on Facebook with you with that one, the 6-year-old boy, and they had their signed copy of your book, and they're in their library, and that is just, I love that they're going to have that book and keep it and read it, and hopefully share
Yeah,
it.
that really warms my heart when these younger generations, you know, are interested in learning about history and World War II and or you know, want to read my book. That's really special.
It is Greatest Generation, absolutely. Anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap this all up?
Also to emphasize that in the book, there's so much about the underground and the resistance and the people who helped my dad, hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends because of the Gestapo found out about it. They would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to concentration camps or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. So that's a really important aspect of the book too, is just honoring and telling the story of those people in the underground.
I agree. I mean, they took so many chances and risked everything, including their lives, their families, everything. So you're so right. I can't wait to get that part of
Yeah, really all the dramas in the second half of the
Oh my
book.
gosh. Yeah. Yep. I'm anxious for you to I'm not writing a book. I'm working on a screenplay, but when I'm done with that, I'd love to share it with you and get your take on that, on my dad's story.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Good for you. I made a little 13-minute documentary about the shot down story. It includes some clips of an interview with my dad, and also some clips from an interview I did with Hans Berger over in Munich a few years ago.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Can you send that to me and I'll be happy to post it on our website with the podcast.
Sure. Yeah, it's on my YouTube channel, so I'll just send you the link to it.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. Because I know folks would love to see that, and I would love to see that. And I'm fascinated by the fact that you found the German pilot. That's incredible.
Oh yeah, it was. I was so excited because
Wow.
all my dad knew and all the Air Force knew was that my dad's plane was shot by two German fighters, and that's all I thought I'd ever know. And then I
Man.
come to find him and learn his story. He was shot down 3 times. Most of all his friends were killed in the war. He himself, he shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire.
Holy cow. Wow. Now, your dad has passed, is that correct?
Yes, he died in 2007. He
Okay.
wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91.
91. Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's too bad that I didn't do all this while he was still living.
Wouldn't he have been amazed by all this that you have done?
Yeah, it would have
Wow.
been
Oh
something.
my gosh, to share that with him, yeah. But like you said, I mean, and I've experienced it too, getting these guys to talk about their experience. It was like pulling teeth. They didn't want to relive it, and that's easily understood.
Yeah, my dad didn't talk about it very much until 1989 when they erected that memorial to him and his crew. And he and the other 3 crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hid him during the war, revisited these places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back.
Wow.
And then he started talking about it after that. And then I made my first trip to Belgium 5 years later in 1994 with my parents.
Yeah.
And that's when it became personal for me because I got to see all these things firsthand.
Oh, well, you relived it through his eyes and to a large extent.
Yeah.
My goodness. Wow. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us today, Steve, and thanks to your dad and mine for their service and undying dedication to our country. These guys' stories just never cease to amaze. So, and your book documents
Absolutely.
such an important part of history that needs to be kept alive.
Well, thank you very much. It was absolutely a labor of love, and it's changed my life and become my passion. It's like a second career, but it's a wonderful, wonderful experience I'm having.
Yeah. Oh, it is wonderful. You know, it means a lot to a lot of people. I see that on a daily basis. So, and I think you're really going to appreciate the song we have today, because it's a song that my husband and I wrote. So let me introduce our musician. And hopefully you can enjoy this song. So bear with me just one sec. And thank you again, Steve. We just can't thank you enough. Okay, if you've listened to our previous podcast, you know we like to showcase original music written and performed by our listeners. We play this episode's song here, then post it at BoomerTube, where you can download it. The name of the artist and their contact information is posted there as well. This week, we welcome back Rob Scholes to the show. Rob is a singer-songwriter from Eagle, Idaho. He used to describe himself as an unrepentant middle-aged stage junkie, but Rob now says that the middle-aged part has left the building. Rob started playing guitar and writing songs when he was 18 because he thought it would be a good way to meet chicks. Spoiler alert, he adds, it worked. He then headlined his living room for the next 15 years. Rob continues to write and perform intriguing music filled with wickedly clever lyrics, and recently headlined a showcase of performers at the Ironwood Bar and Grill in Boise. A special note regarding today's song. Not Forgotten Men was written by Tim and me as a tribute to all those who have served our country, now and in the past. Tim wrote half the song about 30 years ago, and I was always drawn to it, so several months ago we started working on lyrics to finish it. Normally, Tim would have performed it, but since we're currently without anything closely resembling a proper recording studio, we enlisted Rob's help to bring this song to life and share it with the world. We shared this song a few weeks ago during a Vietnam segment, but since it's pretty relevant to today's subject, once again, here is Not Forgotten Men.
Came from Colorado, I was leaning against the wall, looking for a name long gone, someone long ago. And I was dug in deep head first, searching for my friends. This voice came ringing out, this is what they said. If you see our brothers coming, won't you tell them that we're here? Tell them not to be afraid, not to shed a tear, for they'll see our souls are running, running with the wind. And as long as you remember, we are not forgotten men. We were just 18, gung-ho as hell. First stop at a boot camp was a tour in Vietnam. Ain't nobody tougher when you know you are the best. But after 13 months in country, we know we're like the rest. And if you see our brothers coming, won't you tell them that we're here? Tell them not to be afraid, not to shed a tear. For they'll see our souls are running, running with the wind. And as long as you remember, we are not forgotten men. At 20,000 feet, your hands are cold as ice. The flak explodes around you as you're ready for the fight. Check the ammo on the 50s, no time to feel the fear. Thoughts of loved ones come to haunt, remind you why you're here. For every veteran has a fire in their eye, a fire that burns white hot when duty calls. Remember them, their willingness to die. took and pledged to give their all. Well, now we're 1,000 miles from nowhere, doing what we do. There's dancing with the devil, we're all bound to see it through. And we think about our fallen when we look up at the stars. We're bound by love of country, we are all brothers in arms. When you see your brothers coming, won't you tell them that we're here? Tell them not to be afraid, tell them not to shed a tear. For they'll see our souls are running, running with the wind. And as long as you remember, we are not forgotten men. Oh, as long as you remember, we are not forgotten men.
You just heard Not Forgotten Men. A big thank you once again to Rob for helping us out with this one. Great job, sir. We love to hear and play original music, so if you're listening and you're an artist, I hope this inspires you to send us yours. We like to keep it classic, like rock, country, or the blues, but if you've got a tune representing another genre or an instrumental, we would love to hear it. You'll find guidelines for submitting music to us at boomertube.com. Please make it a recording with a group or an instrument. Put on your best voice and let us help you showcase your work, because you never know who might be listening. And as we mentioned at the top of the program, we would love to make your story a part of our podcast. I'd love to hear from you. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, it would mean a lot to us if you would share it with your friends and family. Our sincere thanks once again to our guest, Steve Snyder, for spending some time with us today and for sharing his father's story with us. Once again, the website is boomertube.com, and you can email me at deb@boomertube.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, come play with your own age group. Deb out.